singled out, right, as a separate factor as regards right view on the Noble Eightfold Path. So, of course, what that means is that it is something very important, right? It's very powerful, forming, in a sense, the foundation of the whole practice. And this is something that you see in a number of suttas. You see that generosity is often placed at the very kind of source, the very beginning of the path, as being something which kind of gets everything else going, in a sense. So for that reason, it is important, precisely because it creates that foundation factor. It could have, you would have thought perhaps that generosity was part of the other factors of kindness, right, of virtue and of morality. For example, when you have the precept against stealing, the opposite of that is obviously generosity. But instead of actually being part of general good conduct, it is always singled out as a special factor. And for that reason, it obviously has some importance to it. I think the one of the things that we're trying to get to here with generosity, this is something that you see in the suttas. You see, for example, that some of the higher states of mind in the suttas, the deep meditations, the insights, and all these kind of things, they can only be had when the mind is very open and very free and very generous, and you have this sense of open-heartedness. There's no limitations anymore to your generosity, basically, to you wanting to give, to you wanting to help out others, and all of these things. When your heart kind of opens up, that is only then that it's possible to have these deeper states of meditation on the path. So you can almost—it's almost like you can check yourself and to see, where you're at, in a sense, by judging as regards to your own generosity. And of course, the feeling inside will vary a lot. Some days you don't feel generous at all. Other days you feel really, really generous, right? This will vary a lot, but we want to kind of move in that direction where you feel more open. You feel kind of this, it's almost this want, this desire to help other people inside of you. So this is what we are aiming for. And of course, to do that, you actually have to practice these things. So this is about how to go about practicing generosity, how to do it in such a way that it leads to this more open-heartedness. And again, it is not, generosity is not just about you give in this life and you gain some kind of result in the future life. It's about how it feels now, right? There's a feeling that you have right in this life. That's when it becomes powerful. That's when it becomes like a tool in a meditation practice, right? When you feel that happiness, the joy that comes from these things, you reflect on that. Then you watch the breath. Then it all becomes very powerful. So it's very, getting these things in the right way is very important. So let's have a quick look at some of these little suttas. These are just little extracts. Most of these are extracts from other suttas. Even if I haven't said so, that's what they are. I may have occasionally forgotten to put in the word extract in there. And this first one is an extract from a sutta in the Samyutta Nikaya, Samyutta Nikaya 3.24. This is from number... So 3 here means the Samyutta number. Samyutta means a group of connected discourses. And these discourses, they are connected around King Pasenadi of Kosala. And this is called the Kosala Samyutta, this particular Samyutta. And it's a very nice little Samyutta. If you'd like to read one part of the Samyutta Nikaya, this is actually very nice, this particular chapter. A lot of nice little suttas with the king, quite kind of, sweet, with king and his queen, right? How they kind of work together and how they go and see the Buddha. And kind of some of the questions they have are very kind of simple, ordinary questions, but precisely for that reason, often very useful questions, right? So not kind of very, very profound, but very nice. So it's a very nice little sangyutta, that one. So if you want to read a place where it has many nice suttas collected together, that's actually a nice place to look. Anyway, so this is one of those. And this is a kind of a classic example of the kind of questions that this king would ask of the Buddha. So this is at Savati. This was the seat of King Pasenadi, one of the great cities of India at that time. And sitting to one side, King Pasenadi of Kosala said to the Blessed One, Venerable sir, where should a gift be given? Wherever one's mind has confidence, great king. Right? Where should a gift be given? It's actually quite a good question. Where should a gift be given? It's a kind of a very useful thing, right? And it's something that's worth thinking about. And the answer is not, perhaps you might have thought, oh, it's good to give to the, you know, to the a Buddhist cause or to the Sangha or something like that. But no, the answer is wherever you have confidence. The Pali word for confidence is pasada or pasidati is the verbal form. And this word is actually quite difficult to translate into English. Its meaning is quite broad. It means wherever kind of your mind finds peace, wherever your mind finds confidence, peace, where you get a sense of serenity and you feel kind of, you feel it's natural and easy to give. A place where you kind of your mind leaps forward and you want to give to that place. That is always the right place to give. And this is quite important because sometimes we have these ideas about where we should give, right? We think, oh, this is good to give. Sometimes in the suttas, there are places where the Buddha is speaking to some lay people, and these lay people tell the Buddha, we give gifts to the arahants or to the people who are on the path of arahantship. And then the Buddha says, it's not easy to know who are the arahants in the world, right? It's just an idea in your mind. You don't really know if they're arahants. Maybe they are. You can have some idea, of course, who is spiritually advanced and who is not, but you can't really know these things. And then he tells them, he says to them, well, you know, when you give, give to the Sangha as a whole, because then you include everybody. That is the way to give, if you want to give to a Buddhist Sangha. So give to the Sangha as a whole, and that will include everybody now. And if you give something which is also useful for the future, like, you know, some material requisite or a place to dwell or something like that, then it's for the Sangha now and also for the future. And the whole Sangha, everybody included, everywhere. This is the right way of giving, he says. And so it's important not to have too many ideas about where it is right to give. But feel what feels good to you, right? What feels right? Where are you drawn to giving? Where do you feel a natural sense of compassion? Where do you feel that it is, you know, this would be a nice place to give? That is where it is the right place to give, says the Buddha. And why is that? Well, because a large part of giving is not just kind of, you know, having this merit calculation. If I give there, I get so and so much merit. You know, there's a million times here, but there's a billion times there. Oh, okay, this is the right place. If you become too calculating about these things, the whole thing falls apart. It becomes a matter of greed. It doesn't work anymore. So yes, it matters where you give in that sense, but being too calculating about these things is not going to work. So to go with your emotions, go what feels right. And when you go with what feels right, you will feel more happiness as a result, because you feel this is where it's needed. And then when you give there, that will give rise to joy. So in a sense, you are learning by giving what feels good. You're learning the power of generosity. If you go according to calculations, you will not learn very much at all about the power of generosity, because it will have no emotional impact on you. So this is great, right? So whenever you feel, wow, this is a nice place to give, then it is always a good to give. And it's good to give often, right? It's not just a kind of a one-off thing, but often. It doesn't have to be large amounts or a lot, but, you know, this regular thing is what kind of builds up this understanding of the power of generosity. So this is what the Buddha says. And of course, I'm not saying that you shouldn't give to Buddhist courses. Of course, it's that would be terrible if a Buddhist monk said you shouldn't be given to Buddhist causes. Of course, please give to Buddhist causes. What I'm saying is just that, you know, we need to broaden our heart, broaden our mind to include everything. And then it becomes very beautiful and very powerful. So that is the idea of where one should give. And I'm very glad, you know, it's nice to have a teacher like this, like the Buddha, who is so broad-minded, right? And this next sutta is on a similar kind of topic, a similar kind of thing. And the same kind of point is being made here again, but it has some additional things that are also quite nice. So this is the Buddha speaking to somebody called Vacca. His full name is actually Vacca Gotta. And Vatsagotta is this ascetic, this wanderer who was wandering around India, and this is obviously looking for something, looking for the truth. And there are so many suttas with this one person, this Vatsagotta. It's like he's really haranguing the Buddha, trying to get some answers from him, right? But the Buddha obviously sees that there is some potential in this wanderer. He obviously has some wisdom deep down. So he keeps on teaching him again and again and again. And eventually, this Vatsagotta, he actually ordains and becomes an arahant. So sometimes, you know, the fruits of teaching can be very good if you are able to see the propensities, if you like, the potential in that person for moving forward on the path. Anyway, so this is one of those many suttas with Vatsagotta. And this is what the Buddha says to him after having been asked the question. Those Vatsa who say the ascetic Gotama says, alms should be given only to me, not to others. Alms should be given only to my disciples, not to the disciples of others. Only what is given to me is very fruitful, not what is given to others. Only what is given to my disciples is very fruitful, not what is given to the disciples of others. Those who say that do not state what has been said by me, but misrepresent me with what is untrue and contrary to fact. One who prevents another from giving alms creates an obstruction and stumbling block for three people. What three? He creates an obstruction to the donors acquiring merit, to the recipients gaining a gift, and already he has maimed and injured himself. One who prevents another from giving alms creates an obstruction and stumbling block for these three people. Right? So again, the Buddha is saying that whenever somebody wants to give, you should allow them to give. It's good that they give. It's not as if, you know, there's often we can give every time we want to give. There's a possibility for giving. It's not as if we have to kind of, you know, put our resources into one place. If we give in a wise way, we can give in many, many different places at the same time, or you know, over a long period of time. And this is one of the principles of Buddhism, is this idea of encouraging others to do what is right. Right? So always, and this is part of what we call sila, or what we call right attitude or right habit, is actually encouraging other people on this path as well. So here, if this was true, you would be obstructing people, right? You would be doing the exact opposite of encouraging them. You would say, oh, no need to give over there. There, give over here instead. So this is the exact opposite of what we should be doing. This is an aspect of immorality if you stop other people from doing what is generous. So generosity is always good. It's always a positive thing. It's always to be encouraged. And to stop anybody would always be bad, basically. Except if it's given weapons to, you know, to some kind of fundamentalist group. Of course, then there are certain limits to that. But you know, any kind of good-hearted giving, which is giving in the right place. And interesting, you are injuring yourself, right? Because it is an act of lacks virtue, it lacks the right habit. You're actually injuring yourself if you stop others from doing an act of generosity or any other act of kindness for that matter. And again, I think it's one of those things that you will feel inside. If you stop somebody from doing what is right, you will feel, if you are have enough awareness, you will feel that there's something not quite right about that. So, you should never stop anyone from giving. This is basically the message here. And then what the Buddha says, this is a very nice little thing, which is you know, tucked away in the corner of a sutta somewhere, which you know you don't normally get to hear, but which I remember reading. I thought, wow, that's actually very nice. But Vatsa, I say that one acquires merit even if one throws away dishwashing water in a refuse dump or cesspit with the thought, may the living beings here sustain themselves with this. Right? How much more then does one acquire merit when one gives to human beings? However, I say that what is given to one of virtuous behavior is more fruitful than what is given to an immoral person. And the most worthy recipient is one who has abandoned five factors and possesses five factors. And that last person is the Arahant. Again, it's not the whole sutta, so some bits and pieces are missing there. But basically, that's the Arahant, the last part there. So I like this little idea about even, you know, you are just throwing out the kind of the leftovers in the dishwashing water, right? There's a few rice grains left in the dishwashing water, and you throw that outside, and you think, may those beings out there, you know, for imagine if you are, you know, a little being in a cesspit or something, you're living in filth all the time. Imagine getting a few rice grains, right? Wow, this is really nice stuff. Right? And that's probably what they think, right? So just by thinking that, may these beings, you know, enjoy these rice grains, that already is heading you in the right direction. That's already a powerful act of merit, right? And the whole point here is that if we start to look at our lives in the right way, if we take every opportunity we have to make merit, to do what is good, to do what is kind, there are so many opportunities. If you take these little opportunities like this, and suddenly it kind of accumulates, right? And you can make your whole life into an act of generosity. Everything you do can become an act of generosity. All throughout the day, you can think of good ways of doing things. And in a sense, this is how I, in many ways, regard my monastic life, right? There's always an opportunity to do good. As a monk, almost everything I do, apart from sitting in my kuti by myself, is charity, basically. I don't really get any payment for this. Yes, people come and give me food, which is wonderful, which is kind of generosity going both ways, right? It becomes a very beautiful kind of exchange. But I try to look at almost everything I do, I try to look at it as an act of charity, an act of generosity towards others. Then all these things become much more meaningful and very beautiful. They all become part of the same path. And it's possible to do the same thing in any. Don't have to be a monk or a nun to do that. You can do the same thing in lay life, right? You can make your work, even though you take a salary, you can think of the recipients of what you're doing. You can think of the customers. You can think of the other people in your company who you're also supporting. When you think about it, I'm going to do my best because it helps support so many other people. Then even your everyday work, in your household, with your family, with everything, can become an act of kindness, an act of generosity in this way. It's all about how you reflect. And when you start to reflect and think in the right way, ordinary little activities become meaningful and powerful, and you start to view all of these things in a different way. And life takes a different color. Everything becomes more joyous. Everything acquires a meaning that it never had before. It's great. Yes. And what a wonderful thing. I was just talking to Venerable Karunika yesterday. A couple of days ago, about the nuns' monastery, the building of the nuns' monastery. And she does most of the building work over there. And what a wonderful thing that is, to spend all your time, everything you do, building up a monastery, right? What a powerful thing that is. And again, it's just about using that opportunity in the right way, thinking about it in the right way, and making it into an act of generosity, then it will reap enormous benefits in the long run if you do it in the right way. So that is how the Buddha kind of encourages us, right, to do what is good. Even in the small, ordinary, mundane things of life can become very powerful if we do it in the right way. But then he's also saying that it does matter where we give, right? There's different degrees of generosity according to what we support, right? So if you support something that kind of upholds the happiness and upholds the reduction in suffering for large, large amounts of people in the world, then of course that it is natural that you will gain perhaps ultimately more merit, if you like, or more happiness from that, if you're able to, you know, to do that in a good way. And that is really what a gift to a Buddhist cause is about. If you give to like the Buddha Society or Bodhinyana Monastery, the idea is that here you are giving to an organization that gives out the Dhamma to literally hundreds of thousands of people around the world, right? And it is helping these people in their lives. And then you are, you know, supporting this big movement we call Buddhism. And of course that, obviously, as long as Buddhism is a good thing, that will be a very powerful thing to do. So that's why the Buddha says, you know, the highest thing is to support the Arahant, because the Arahant is just the embodiment, the walking embodiment of Dhamma, right? The walking Dhamma, pure kindness, pure compassion, pure generosity, no defilements. And when you see the Arahant, you think, oh, wow, that's powerful, just seeing the Arahant. And then you hear the Dhamma, and it's coming from the right place, and everything is just right. So, yes. Okay. So that is that little sutta. Only small little suttas here. But these are kind of things that I have noticed as I have been reading the word of the Buddha. You notice these little things that you feel are powerful for, they're very powerful for me. And usually my guess is that if it's powerful for me, it's likely to be powerful for other people as well. But anyway, so that is that one there. And then we come on to the next one. This is from a different collection of suttas. This is from a small little book known as the Itivuttaka. Itivuttaka means something like thus, that which has been said thus, or something like that, Itivuttaka. And this is one of the a collection. This is quite interesting in its own right, that this collection of suttas was done by a lay woman at the time of the Buddha. She heard a lot of suttas from the Buddha, and then she collected these together, and that became the Itivuttaka. So, again, that is quite interesting, that origin of those suttas there, the fact that they took them in from everywhere. So that is a good thing here. And that Itivuttaka also exists in Chinese translation, so this is obviously a fairly ancient text. And this is one of those little suttas from the Itivuttaka, if people knew the result of giving here. O monks, if people knew, as I know, the result of giving and sharing, they would not eat without having given, nor would they allow the stain of niggardliness, of miserliness, right, to obsess them and take root in their minds. Even if it were their last morsel, their last mouthful, they would not eat without having shared it, if they were someone to share it with. But monks, as people do not know, as I know, the result of giving and sharing, they eat without having given, and the stain of niggardliness obsesses them and takes root in their minds. So you should never eat without sharing what you're eating, ideally, right? I mean, these days, I guess, there's so much food going around usually, but still, if you have something special, you have something nice, right, to share it is always very powerful and very, very good. This is a very nice thing. One of the things in the suttas as well, the Buddha talks about, when you want to give a gift, in those days, a lot of people were farmers. It was a very kind of agrarian society in India at that time. And because of that, he encouraged people to give, like, the first harvest, right, the best of the crop that was taken in. If you give that, you're like giving the best. And this is kind of a similar kind of vein. When you give good things, you can expect a lot of high return on that one, because you're giving what is good, and that has a more powerful impact on you, of course. Because you feel that you're really giving something away that has value. So, anyway, just a nice thought, this thought of always giving and sharing. Every time you eat something, right, if you understood, as the Buddha said, if you really understand the power of giving, you would never eat without sharing. Right? This is how powerful it is. Very interesting here. And this idea of not allowing the stain of miserliness to obsess you. And this stain of miserliness is like the mind which doesn't want to share, right? The mind which says, this is mine, this is, I don't want to give it to anybody else. This is the stain of miserliness. And that stain is actually painful. If you compare the mind which wants to share and wants to give, you compare that to the mind which doesn't want to share, doesn't want to give, it's like One state is a happy state, and you feel good about yourself. And the other one is actually quite a painful, very limited state, and you don't feel good about yourself in the same way. And that feeling of feeling goodness, feeling good about yourself, again, this is that beautiful open-heartedness where you want to share with everyone, right? And that is the kind of mind that will take you into samadhi. Without that, there's no way you will get into deep states of meditation. So this whole thing about giving is to move you in that direction. Okay. Then we have another sutta, now from the Anguttara Nikaya 4. And this is called Worthy Deeds. Okay. And it goes as follows. There are these four other things that lead to obtaining the four things that are wished for, desired, agreeable, and rarely gained in the world. So these things that are wished for, desired, and agreeable, and rarely gained in the world, these things are things like, what are they again? Things like, you know, having enough possessions, you know, being kind of being well off, I suppose, having a good reputation, achieving a good rebirth is one of those. And there's a fourth one. I can't remember now. I haven't read this for quite a while. But something like that. And this is how to do that, through basically an act of generosity or kindness. With wealth acquired by an energetic striving, amassed by the strength of his arms, earned by the sweat of his brow, righteous wealth righteously gained, the noble disciple undertakes four worthy deeds. What for? So the first thing you will notice here is that the power of giving is greater if it is righteous things, right? These are things that you have worked for. These are things that are truly yours because you have actually spent your energy, spent your time in acquiring these things. You're not just gone down to the corner shop and stolen them off the shelf, anything like that. This is actually really yours, right? And that is when it feels good to give it away. This is the interesting thing. If you have gotten it by kind of, you know, avoiding, you know, by cheating or whatever, then it doesn't have the same power. It is when it is truly yours and you're really giving up something that is yours, that is when it becomes particularly powerful. So this is interesting because this is kind of the starting point here. So this is the four types of deeds. The first one here, householder, with wealth acquired by energetic striving, righteously gained, the noble disciple makes himself, right, himself or herself happy and pleased, and properly maintains himself in happiness. He makes his parents happy and pleased, and properly maintain them in happiness. He makes his wife and children, his slaves, workers, and servants happy and pleased, and properly maintain them in happiness. He makes his friends and companions happy and pleased, and properly maintains them in happiness. This is the first case of wealth that has gone to good use, that has been properly utilized and used for a worthy cause. So this is quite interesting, isn't it? It is allowable to make yourself happy here. Right, you use the wealth to make yourself happy. Yourself, you are the first person on the list there. So you are allowed to use that, to indulge a little bit, to use it for good things. You don't have to live in a super ascetic lifestyle all the time if you are a lay person and you've chosen that life. Sometimes you use that wealth in such a way that it makes you happy, whatever way that is, without, of course, doing stupid things, obviously, but in ways that, you know, feels good. So this is the first one, and this is interesting. And it's interesting how the Buddha always tends to put oneself highest on the list, right? We are closest to ourselves. If there's any person that we understand the happiness of more than anybody else, it is ourselves. And that is why we are on top of the list. We can always ensure our own happiness more easily than that of anybody else. And then the second one is parents, right? Here parents come in again. Parents are number two. So you make them happy. You don't just kind of support them, but you give them a little bit extra, something more, to make them happy and pleased. then your wife and children, or I guess your husband and children, right? Depending on times have changed a little bit. So whatever is the appropriate one there. And his slaves, workers and servants. So I'm sure not too many of you will have too many slaves. But the slaves in India were treated better. They weren't often treated that badly. It's quite different from slaves at elsewhere in the world. There are slaves in many other countries, like in Europe at times, in the Americas, they were treated extremely badly. But in India, they were treated a bit like servants, except that they didn't have any freedom. They kind of belonged to that household. But you can see here, you're supposed to make them happy, right? You're supposed to kind of give them something extra, do something for them. So this is, you can see how you're supposed to look after everybody here. And then the last one is your friends and companions. You make them happy and pleased too. So this is the first way of using wealth, making people happy, making yourself happy included. Number two, again, with wealth acquired by energetic striving, righteously gained, the noble disciple makes provisions against the losses that might arise from fire, floods, kings, thieves, and displeasing heirs. He makes himself secure against them. This is a second case of wealth that has gone to good use for a worthy cause. So this is not so much about generosity. This is just about using wealth in a good way. So you use wealth to make reasonably sure that, things don't get lost or stolen or whatever. Number three. Again, with wealth acquired by energetic striving, righteously gained, the noble disciple makes the five oblations. Oblations like gifts, basically, here. To relatives, gifts, offerings, to relatives, guests, ancestors, the king, and the deities. This is the third case of wealth that has gone to good use for a worthy cause. So this is interesting one, right? Five kind of oblations or offerings. Some of these are fairly obvious to relatives. You can see why that is the case. So you may give occasional gifts. I think this is what is meant here, occasional gifts to various relatives, to guests, right? It is one of those things that throughout history, in almost all cultures, it has been there is this idea that when there is a guest, you're supposed to receive them into your house in a good way. This is something you see across the world, I think, in almost all cultures. And it was also the case in India at this time. When there is a guest, you receive people well in your house and you treat them in a good way, even giving them a gift if they are there. Ancestors, right? So this is what we do in Buddhism as well. We do something for our ancestors. We give a gift, right? Sometimes we give them on their to the monastery, but to do it for them. Sometimes in Buddhism, it almost seems that you can give the gifts directly as well to ancestors. I'm not sure if that is a Buddhist idea or something that has come into Buddhism from the outside. Possibly the latter of those. But certainly we do things on behalf of the deceased. And you give to the king, right? That's very, very smart. The king is always a dangerous person in those societies. So you give him the occasional gift to make sure that the king is pleased and happy. To make sure he doesn't become too difficult. But you try to do it in a good way, right? So you feel good about it. And the last one here, to the deities, right? This is interesting. Again, I'm not entirely sure whether this is truly a Buddhist idea. It's very marginal. It's a very small thing in the suttas. You don't see this kind of idea very much. But it occurs in a few places. So I'm not sure whether it is something that has kind of crept into the suttas from the outside or it really is a Buddhist idea. Occasionally, there are things that have crept in. One can actually pinpoint those things sometimes. Whether this is that or not, I'm not sure. But there certainly is the idea in Buddhism of kind of deities might guard you, right? If we believe that there are beings out there who live in a kind of a higher realm with more happiness, and because they are more powerful than us, it seems reasonable to think that they may have some kind of influence in human affairs if they want to. And it is said in other suttas that if you are especially a particularly good person, right? Somebody very virtuous and very, very good and does all the right things. Then it is said that sometimes these deities, they might protect you, right? So if something is about to go wrong, suddenly you find yourself saved in a certain way. And this is an idea that you find around the world in many, many cultures. I think perhaps all cultures, this idea that there are higher beings that can save, can do something, can intervene in your life. Like in Western culture, we talk about guardian angels, right? It's not about God, it's about guardian angels, these higher beings who can intervene in your life. So here is, you know, you are kind of giving oblation or a gift to these deities. Not sure exactly how you do that. Maybe you just say to them, oh, you know, I do this for you and you, and whatever. Maybe just putting out something on a little shrine in your garden. I know in many Buddhist countries, it's very common. You have a shrine, perhaps, in your garden, and you put out things there for your ancestor, for the deities, or whatever. It might be as simple as that. But anyway, it's an interesting idea. Whether that, again, whether it really is Buddhist or not, I'm not entirely sure. So now we come to the last one. Again, with wealth acquired by energetic striving, righteously gained, the noble disciple establishes an uplifting offering of alms, an offering that is heavenly, resulting in happiness, conducive to heaven, to those ascetics and Brahmins, right, like the religious people or whatever, who refrain from intoxication and heedlessness, who are settled in patience and mildness, who tame themselves, calm themselves, and train themselves for Nibbana. This is the fourth case of wealth that has gone to good use, that has been properly employed and used for a worthy cause. So if you add up all of those four things, basically there isn't many places where you shouldn't be giving, right? It's pretty much, it's maybe not entirely all-inclusive, but a lot is included there. These householders are the four worthy deeds that the noble disciple undertakes with wealth acquired by energetic striving, amassed by the strength of his arms, earned by the sweat of his brow, righteous wealth, righteously gained. When anyone exhausts wealth from anything apart from these four worthy deeds, that wealth is said to have gone to waste, to have been squandered, to have been used frivolously. But when anyone exhausts wealth on these four worthy deeds, that wealth is said to have gone to a good use, to have been properly used, to have been utilized for a worthy cause. So, don't squander your wealth. Use it wisely. That is what the Buddha is saying here. Use it in a way that causes happiness, right, for everyone around, and especially in the end for yourself. Okay. Then we have a very short sutta called the Exposition of Offerings, the Dakinavibhanga Sutta from the Majjhima Nikaya. And this is very famous, in particular relevant for here in Perth, because it talks about the offering to the Sangha and what is the highest offering to the Sangha. And this is interesting, especially in a place where we have bhikkhunis, as we have here in Perth. Well, there are seven kinds of offerings made to the Sangha, Ananda. One gives a gift to the Sangha of both bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, headed by the Buddha. This is the first kind of offering made to the Sangha. So the first means the highest, right? The one where there is most, the result is the highest. One gives a gift to a Sangha of both bhikkhus and bhikkhunis after the Tathagata has attained final Nibbana. This is the second kind of offering made to the Sangha. So again, the second type of Sangha offering, again, is giving both to the bhikkhus and the bhikkhunis. So, again, interesting, isn't it? And this, again, is this idea that for Buddhism to be considered complete, you have to have the fourfold assembly, bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, laymen, laywomen, and then you have the full kind of contingent of Buddhism. So that is interesting. So when you do an offering, remember that you offer to both sanghas at the time, and this makes it even more powerful. Okay, so now we are coming to the last sutta about generosity. This is another one, just again reinforcing the same point. This one is called Ablaze. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Savati in Jeta's Grove and at Apindika's Park. Then, when the night had advanced, a certain Devata, a deity of stunning beauty, illuminating the entire Jeta's Grove, approached the Blessed One. Having approached, he paid homage to the Blessed One, stood to one side, and recited these verses in the presence of the Blessed One. When one's house is ablaze, the vessel taken out is the one that is useful, not the one left burnt inside. So, when the world is ablaze with the fires of old age and death, one should take out one's wealth by giving. What is given is well salvaged. What is given yields pleasant fruit, but not what is not given. Thieves take it away, or kings. It gets burnt by the fire or is lost. Then, in the end, one leaves the body along with one's possessions. Having understood this, the wise person should enjoy himself, but also give. Having given and enjoyed, it fits his means. Blameless, he goes to the heavenly state. So this idea of giving is like taking the vessel out of the burning house, right? If you don't give your money, it's like leaving the vessel behind, and it gets burnt up together with the house. It doesn't get a chance to be used anymore. It is wealth that is squandered, as it said in the sutta earlier on. So, there you are. That is some of those suttas on giving. One thing I probably maybe should have said yesterday, because yesterday there was a question about somebody asked about, they had a son who was depressed. What should one do for someone who is depressed? What can we do for them? And I remember some time ago I read an article from somewhere in the United States, and they had done a survey about people who were depressed, and what do they do to get out of that depression? What kind of strategy do they use? And most people have kind of silly strategies, like they go to the fridge and get something to eat, or they go to see a movie or something like that, right? And it's, of course, it helps a little bit, right? It takes your mind off the depression or whatever. But there was a tiny minority of people, I can't remember the percentage, maybe 1% or something. And what they did when they were feeling a bit down and depressed was that they would go out and do an act of service, right? They would go out into the community, do an act of generosity, do something positive for other people. And this is one of the great ways to kind of help of overcoming that depression. It takes your mind off yourself. You don't think about yourself so much. And you focus on the needs of others instead. A very, very beautiful way. And it gives, also because, of course, it gives happiness, the very fact that you're doing something kind. So that is a possibility if you know somebody who's depressed, is to actually encourage them to go out and do an act of charity somewhere, do something good, something positive. So that is always a nice thing to do. And also, one of the things that is always nice and I would recommend you to do is when you hear nice stories about people doing acts of kindness and generosity, please tell each other those stories. I find it so uplifting when I hear stories of kindness and generosity, right? People do good things, and it just shows us that there is a lot of good things in this world. And I remembered, I was just thinking about this earlier today, and I recall the story I was told maybe about 20 years ago. It certainly came back to mind again. It's amazing how these stories tend to stick in your mind because they are kind of strong. And this was a story, this was a woman who was originally from Sri Lanka. And she had a niece, and she was kind of praising this niece for being such a very generous person. And some of you may have heard this story, but she said that one day this niece she was wearing a brand new dress, right? And then this other person, a friend or whatever, came around And she saw her in this new dress. And she said to her, "Wow, what a beautiful, that's a very, very nice dress. What a beautiful dress that is." And then this niece said, "I will give it to you." And then she took off the dress and she gave her the dress, right? Right there on the spot, like a spontaneous act of kindness and generosity. Isn't that that's quite beautiful, isn't it? It's like this immediate, instead of attaching to something that you have just got, something which, normally we attach to things, right? You just got a new dress, wow, you feel so good in it. Straight away, instead of holding on, you give it away instead. So that had kind of stuck in me, that little story here. And other things that kind of I find also inspiring is when I think about, you think about people in the world who are very successful in one way or another, very wealthy perhaps. People like, I think especially about people like Bill Gates, right? Bill Gates, he has been the wealthiest man in the world for so many years running here. I don't know how many billions he's worth, but it's, astonishing here. And then towards, after he has kind of finished his career, I don't know how old he is now, maybe around 60 or something. But now he's turning his whole life into an act of generosity. And he says he wants to give away pretty much, 95% or 98% or whatever of his wealth. He just wants to give it away. Right? Isn't that a wonderful example? Sometimes you hear about wealthy people, they are stingy, they're not kind of, not generous at all. But those people here, not only him, but there are others as well, like Warren Buffett, one of the other kind of most wealthy people in the world. The same idea. And they're kind of getting together, building up this enormous fund, and then distributing money to worthy causes around the world. Medicine for people in need, education, right? All these things that there is such a lack of anywhere in the world. And of course, it's great when you get a massive fund like that, you're actually able to make a little bit of impact on things. And then you start to get this feeling, well, why is it that they are so wealthy in the first place, right? And very likely it's because this generosity that they have in this life is just a carryover from something that is very deeply ingrained in them. It's there. It is something very, very powerful aspect in their psychological makeup, in a sense. These are beautiful examples of, in my opinion, of how life is well lived, right? And you're actually using that wealth in a smart way, in a good way, in a useful way. And as you do that, you're opening up your heart, you're opening up yourself. And there comes a day when you get this feeling, right? You just want to give to everybody. I'm sure many of you have had that feeling before. It's like your heart opens up and you just want to give. And it's such a beautiful feeling when that happens, when you almost can't stop yourself from wanting to give to the whole world, to anybody. Anybody comes along, you kind of want to help them out. And that is the kind of thing we're aiming for. And when you get to that stage, that is when you get into the stage of the recollection of generosity, the chaganusati. You're remembering your kindness and goodness, and it gives rise to such happiness. It opens up your heart. Then when you meditate, it is very powerful and very has this incredible impact. And your meditation goes so deep because of that. Okay, so that is, I think, enough for this afternoon. So that is the ending of Write to You. And we'll see you again tomorrow, this evening, actually.